Our talk today, Lost at Sea, comes from the 27th chapter of Acts. This is a chapter in Acts that depicts Paul's voyage to Rome, and it closes out the book of Acts with this voyage. Our seed thought from this comes from a talk many years ago by Brother Ray Luke, in which he suggested that this last voyage has something to do with the journey of the church through the harvest on their way to the center of universal authority. That would be Rome. But along the way, disaster is going to strike. There's going to be a shipwreck. And in fact, there is going to be a wreck of the ship of state that this world is going through before the kingdom finally is unleashed. Now, we're going to go back a little bit to the Old Testament to set the predicate for the experiences of the church through the harvest. Now, on the board here, we have a little background that you will recognize as something that pertains to the experiences of the prophet Elijah. In the 17th chapter of 1 Kings is where we are introduced to Elijah at a period in Israel's history when there was thorough degradation, when the 10-tribe kingdom had broken away from the 2 tribes in the south. King Jeroboam in the north took a policy of deliberate cultural change so that the Israelites would not feel inclined to go back to Jerusalem and be knit again to that same kingdom. And among the changes he made was one that was disastrous. He set up 2 golden calves to worship Jehovah in the form of a calf. And this sin was repeated by king after king after king until you come to the time of King Ahab. Ahab was so wicked, he took the wife Jezebel, who introduced, now for the first time in Israel, foreign worship. Now, idolatry had already been there, but they were still worshiping Jehovah. But now they began the worship of Baal. And that was so degraded that Elijah stepped forward and said, "There will not be rain except by my word for these 3 years." And you remember the account is that there were 3.5 years of drought. Now, we don't know that from the Old Testament. We know that from Luke and from James. There were 3.5 years, and this is a symbol of the 1,260 years of spiritual drought that came upon the Christian world because of the apostasy of great papacy. Now, that lasted, we often say, to about 1799. I think that's the right date. And from that time forward, Elijah looked like there was going to be a period of great victory. There was a stunning victory at the confrontation of the priest of Baal. But when Jezebel got news of this, she threatened his life again, and he had to flee for his life to Mount Horeb, which is the same as Mount Sinai. And you remember the passage, it's in 1 Kings 18, that as he was fleeing for his life, he rested under a juniper tree, and an angel fed him. And then after the feeding, he laid down and he went to sleep, being so tired. An angel woke him up and fed him a second time. Says, "The journey is too great for thee." And he went a second time for feeding. And then it says he went in the strength of that for 40 days until he got to Mount Horeb. Now, I would just suggest to you that first feeding after the close of the 1260 years would be the feeding of the church through the Adventist movement of the early 1800s. But then, you know what it says in Matthew 25 about the parable of the 5 virgins that went to meet their Lord? It says, as he tarried, they all slumbered and slept. And I think that parable has its setting towards the end of the age. As the thoughtful of Christianity went out to meet their Lord. But while he seemed to tarry, because the Adventist movement was disappointed in their date expectations, they slumbered and slept. And the angel woke them up, fed them a second time, and I think that second feeding is the message of present truth that has nourished all of us. And the church went in the strength of that for 40 days to Mount Horeb. That would take you then from the Lord's return 40 days later, 40 day for a year, to 1914. And there, 1 Kings 19 picks up the narrative, and Elijah is brought to the cave, and he's brought to the mouth of the cave, and God shows him the wind that sweeps across the mountain, the earthquake that breaks the rocks, and then the fire that swept across the plain, until finally it ended in the still small voice. Now, you've heard this before. We're just refreshing your memory because this is a prophetic picture, as it were, of the harvest of the gospel age and the troubles we go through preparatory to the kingdom when the still small voice of peace speaks forward. What we want to highlight here is the wind, the earthquake, and the fire as three stages of trouble we go through from 1914 until the kingdom of God is established upon the earth. That first problem, the winds. Well, in Daniel, the seventh chapter, winds represent the winds of war which drive upon the great sea. And I think during the harvest we have seen a phase of trouble that we've gone through and it's now past. But it was a dynamic wind war phase. That was World War I, and its even more disastrous successor, World War II. That was the wind phase, and we propose that that ended in 1945 with the close of World War II. Now you remember the words that Jesus said, when you see the fig tree and all the trees bud forth, you know the kingdom of God is near. That's Luke 21, 28 to 31. Well, after World War II, we saw that. We saw in 1948 Israel bud forth, and because the colonial powers began to break up, I think that's the earthquake, you saw the independence of a variety of nations in Indochina, Indonesia, you found it in Africa, and all the colonial powers worldwide began to get separate independence. I think that earthquake phase, now that we're beyond that, maybe we can look back and say that climaxed with 1989 and the breakup of the last big satellite empire, and that was the Soviet Union. Now, when that broke up, frankly, it took me by surprise a little bit. I really thought we were going to see the Soviet Union play a role as the Soviet Union right to the very end. But it didn't happen that way. Now, some brethren did expect such a thing. Very few. Some have told me. However they did, I credit their perception here. I didn't. But looking retrospectively, I think that is the end of that quake period when the last colonial big empire broke up. And now we're in another phase. I think now we're in that fire phase. Now, again, you have to live through this to have a little historical perspective. But I remember sitting in an airport about 1990, was it, about a year after the breakup of the Soviet Union, and hearing this report about Iraq invading Kuwait. And it struck me so odd. It's like waking up to hear that Brazil has invaded Colombia or something. What is this? Is this a blip on the radar? Or is this a meaningful next step? I didn't know at the time. But now looking back, I suggest it was a meaningful event. We went through Iraq 1. We're not yet through Iraq 2 or Afghanistan or all the embroilment of the Islamic problem that has bubbled over. And I think now that that fire stage is really the fire of Islamic terrorism and trouble and distress that we are just in the beginning of. And as these lasted 3-4 decades, the first two, I think we're in this for a similar period of time as well. I think we're just at the beginning of that fire phase. We've got some decades to go through. Now, we point out these three phases because we're going to see this when we go to our next passage. And that's Acts chapter 27. And that has to do with Paul's voyage to Rome. Now, for that, we're going to flip to a next chart. So just remember those three stages, the wind, the earthquake, and the fire. As we go to this next, which is a map of the Mediterranean area that Paul took his journey through. Now, we mentioned this is in Acts chapter 27, and we're not going to have time to go thoroughly through each part of this and each text. So we're going to kind of summarize for you what Acts chapter 27 says. It says that they start off here, Paul, a prisoner of the Roman authorities. He leaves from a place called Caesarea, named after, of course, Caesar. And his centurion that is over him as a captor is named Julius. Can't get much of a name that reminds you much more of the Roman authority. And so by these two, I think our attention is directed to the fact that Paul represents the Lord's people that are still subject to the powers that be. Now, a little predicate for this, perhaps. It was some time ago that our attention was directed to the book of Acts as a whole and how the book of Acts opens up the whole of the gospel age as it goes forward. You'll see that right from the beginning when Jesus said early in Acts, "Tarry at Jerusalem until the Holy Spirit comes." and then you will be my disciples, my witnesses rather, in Jerusalem, in Judea, in Samaria, and to the uttermost parts of the earth. And you know, you go through Acts and it happens just that way. It happened first, you see the witness activities at Jerusalem, two prominent ones that swelled the church to something like 5,000 members. And then next, you see something that happened in Judea, because when Stephen was stoned and the brethren were scattered throughout Judea, they brought the truth wherever they went. And so it went from Jerusalem to Judea. And then in the 8th chapter of Acts, you have record about the witness activity in Samaria, where Philip and another disciple were, and they had to call back to get the apostles to lay their hands on them to give them the Holy Spirit. And then in the 9th chapter, in the 10th and onward, you have the introduction. Well, before we go that far, excuse me. You have that Ethiopian eunuch that Philip talks to, and he takes the truth back to Ethiopia, to the uttermost parts of the earth. Well, going through the rest of Acts and all of Paul's journeys, we just drop a thought here. We don't have time to elaborate too much. That through Paul's life, you have a panoramic picture of how the gospel unfolds step by step through the gospel age until the end. So the last chapters, Paul's journey to Rome, we believe suggests for us the voyage of the church through the harvest until the kingdom finally comes. Well, let's see, as we go through this, whether this it makes a consistent picture. Is this on, by the way?
No.
Okay. Then I'm okay. I can't do anything to shut it off, so it's off. Okay. Acts 27, verse 1. When it was determined that we should sail into Italy, they delivered Paul and certain other prisoners to one named Julius, a centurion of Augustus's band, and entering into a ship of Adramyttium, we launched, meaning to sail by the coast of Asia. So they launched out from here. They're on their way to Rome, the center of universal authority, and they're going to go first by the coasts of Asia Minor. The first port of call that they make is this city on the coast called Sidon. Now, you know Tyre and Sidon were those twin cities. And you know that Tyre is a picture of great Christendom. And in Ezekiel, the 28th chapter, you have something about this. And I'm sure there's nuances of the picture. We're not going to get into any of those nuances, except this. We'll suggest that Tyre and Sidon represent the two powers of Christendom, and that Sidon, by comparison, is the Protestant power. And wasn't it the first stage of the harvest period that was really a gathering out of the Protestant systems primarily that brought the brethren into the truth movement through the divine plan and through the message of present truth? Well, I think we see that when it says in verse 3, the next day we touched Sidon, and Julius courteously entreated Paul and gave him liberty to go to his friends to refresh himself. That's a highly unusual mention. If you were on a ship as a prisoner of Rome on your way to some trial, the last thing I would expect is that your captor would treat you courteously and let you have some days of refreshment and fellowship with the brethren. Paul apparently was a very striking character. Later on, the captor, the centurion, takes pains to make sure that Paul would be preserved. He apparently had a bond with him because of Paul's personality. Here, that was adequate to give him the favor of being refreshed with the brethren. And I think that Sidon, where he had fellowship with the brethren, represents the early part of the harvest. I would say that's the first 40 years that we saw in that chart about Elijah, where they go in the strength of the nourishment of present truth for 40 years till they get to the time of trouble. Now, that trip was very uneventful, and the sweet fellowship they had was very wonderful. But as soon as they launched out from there, immediately they hit the headwinds, and they passed through two seas. It says they passed through the Sea of Cilicia and the Sea of Pamphylia before they were to make dock. We will suggest that that first phase of the wind phase correlates with Elijah's wind phase. Now that wind phase, because we've lived through it, we know that it was in two phases. We know it was World War I. Might have thought that would be it, maybe introduce our... No, it went on a little gap and then World War II. But now we've been through that. And we haven't had for decades another world war. I don't think we will. I know some brethren wonder if there might be a nuclear exchange and a Holocaust and a third. I don't think so. I think that wind phase is concluded. It doesn't mean no more wind at all. It means that dynamic world war scenario has finished. It did its job. It broke up some of the old kingdoms. That's what it was destined to do. That wind phase, we suggest, is over. And now, when they come to Myra and they dock there, having gone through two seas, two stages of the wind trouble that this ship hit, now something happens here. They change ship. They find another ship. This one's from Alexandria, and it's a grain ship, and that ship is headed on its way to Rome. Isn't it true that after World War II, we're in a different ship of state? The old kings and the old governments of Europe really are gone. We're in a new situation, a new group of powers. In fact, they even started a new congregation of nations, the United Nations, as a consequence. We're in a new form, as it were, of government, of governmental structure. And they launch out from there, but they stay by the coast of Asia, the old world, as it were, until they pass by this place called Cnidos. Now, in the scripture, it's like Cnidus or something, but that really is a silent sea, and it should be pronounced Cnidos. And to this day, there is a city in Turkey called Cnidos. I've got it shown here out in the water because it actually juts out at a peninsula. It's the last call, as it were, before finally you leave that old world altogether. And it was very slow going during that passage. And I think that represents the period of time when from 1945 until finally the end of that earthquake phase, it was slow going from 1945 to 1989. There was a Cold War during this time. They still had headwinds during this time, not intense, but it was slow going. But now they leave. And I would propose, just to put it as a suggestion, that last tip of the mainland sees us departing altogether from the old arrangement into a new situation altogether. I would call it, as George Bush I did, a new world order. And I think that was when the Soviet Union broke up. And now we're in uncharted waters, as it were. Now, I remember that time. We talked about it earlier. And I wondered what prevents us at this point from sailing onto the kingdom. And actually, a mariner that was sailing from here to Rome would take that route and they'd just go directly. But it turns out, as soon as they launched out, they hit wind again and they had to divert down here to Crete for the safety of the island. And I think that shows after 1989. Within a year or two, we saw the winds of war strike up again with the first Iraq conflict. Not like the old world wars. That phase is over. But it was a war that wins nevertheless. And so we're diverted. And we come down past this area. And it says the next port of call they barely passed by is a place called Salmone. Now, if this is the first 40 years of the harvest, this is the wind phase. There's the earthquake phase, and we finally leave every vestige of the old world, as it were, into a new world order. What's next? Well, what's next is the Islamic problem. And that hit us with Iraq 1 and Iraq 2. Those are over now. Well, Iraq 2, we're still embroiled in a little bit. But they come by here, past this place called Salmone, which means sea billows. And these sea billows, that would be an appropriate place for it. That's where the billows roll in, as it were. Maybe that suggests to us the next form of trouble that we're even now embroiled in. And I think it does. Now, this takes us down in Acts chapter 27 to verse 7. So we've gone to a very short space through this 27th chapter. We've got 44 verses to go through. We've only gone to verse 7 so far, and I think this suggests that the remainder of this chapter really focuses on the time from there forward to Armageddon. That's the time that we're in today. The focus of the most of this chapter deals with the experiences that are before us, that we've passed through, and that we're maybe going to see develop more earnestly in the future. What have we been through in recent years? Well, do you remember when 2000 came? There was a serious dip. There was a serious dip in the economy. There was a serious dip in the stock market. I remember that time. I remember the stock market, the NASDAQ was up to 5,000, and it's dipped down less than half. And you know where we are today? Somewhere still less than half of that. The Dow Jones is up 14,000. It has not yet. It's down, what, 9,000 something these days? We have really not fully recovered from that billow. But now we've got another one. It took 8 or 9 years to develop, and now we've got the commercial, we've got the real estate market crisis. And I wouldn't have thought real estate by itself would be something to shake the world, but it seems to have. It seems to have shaken the world economies. Some predict we're coming out. Some predict we got another step down. I don't know which way it's going to be. But I think maybe this is the second billow of difficulty. Now, if you go back to the fall of the Soviet Union in 1989, what was the world looking forward to at that point? Now, we're looking forward to the kingdom. But the world didn't know anything about that. With the fall of communism, they're thinking all eyes are fixed on capitalism. That's the answer. The West has prospered, and that's the only answer for us. But now the next event begins to wither that prospect. Now, go back just in your mind's eye a little bit to Revelation, the 16th chapter, and see how the closing experiences of this harvest are depicted in seven last plagues. That last one is Armageddon. That's going to be the shipwreck we're coming to in this picture in a few moments. But before that, you have this withering, this drying up of the River Euphrates. The River Euphrates is what brought commercial life support to the city of Great Babylon. So you dry up the River Euphrates, you're drying up its commercial prospects. And it's symbolically, is that perhaps what we are seeing happen today? We're seeing the withering of the Western economies, only starting now. We've gone through one billow. We're in the middle of another one. Do we have a third one to go, maybe in another decade or so? Possibly so. But it says they scarcely passed by this place, and they came in the underbelly of Crete to a place of safety. Now, if I was writing this as a book, I couldn't choose a name more fitting to that next dock. It was called Fair Haven. Fair Haven is where they dock, they port, and there's a measure of safety. I think this suggests for us that after we pass through these billows, we're not at the end. Maybe there'll be some stability for a period of time. Now, that might be 10, 20 years out in the distance. If these billows are every decade or so, I would say that's maybe 10, 20 years out in the distance before we come to that point. But there they dock, and now the season is changing. Now winter is approaching. You remember what Jesus said in Matthew 24? Pray that your flight be not in the winter, because the harvest is largely past at that time. Jeremiah 8:20, the harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we're still here. We're not saved. Well, pray that your flight be not in the winter. But now Paul speaks. We see in Acts 27, verse 9, now when much time was spent, and when sailing was now dangerous, because the fast was now already past, Paul admonished them, and he says, sir, I perceive that this voyage will be with hurt and with much damage, only with not only the lading and the ship, but also of our own lives. So Paul steps forward here, and he says, be grateful for the safety you've got. Don't try to launch out. Well, what did they have in mind? They thought they were going to launch from here and go out to this place called Phoenix. Now, we have a place called Phoenix in the southwest of the United States, you know, not so far from us. And I know what that word means. That's named after the mythological bird that rose out of the ashes. Is this a suggestion that they're trying to regain something of former times that they had lost? Well, what is it that prophecy tells us is going to happen at this time? In Revelation, in the sixth plague, it says at this time, there's going to be a disposition among the powers that be to lean on each other for mutual support. You remember in Revelation 16, when the River Euphrates dries up in the sixth plague, then the beast, papacy, the false prophet, I think that's the two-horned beast, Protestantism, and then the civil government, the dragon, they lean to each other in a common union to shore up support. They're trying to regather something they had. But it's not the answer God has in mind. This is not going to be the answer of the kingdom. The kingdom will follow. We know that's coming. But what the world is scheming to try to lean on each other for support and bolster up the order, that's not what God has in mind. In the Old Testament, in 1 Kings chapter 22, you find a picture of this coalition. You find a time when Ahab invited Jehoshaphat to join forces, and the whole thing was sealed by a two-horned leader at Church of England. And among that coalition, you find one person, the prophet of Jehovah, that stepped forward and said, "This is not going to prosper. If you try this venture, you're going to find out you're going to lose the battle, and you're going to end up losing your life, and it's going to be disastrous." So Ahab says, send this prophet back to prison until I come back in peace. And Micaiah yells after him, "If you come back at all, I'm not a prophet of God." And sure enough, Ahab did not. He died in the field of battle. I think that's the church saying at this point in time, this is not the answer. Your plans to recover and strengthen the old world are not going to work. You should be looking forward to something better. That's what Paul says. I think Paul is a picture of the Lord's people that gives this message. Your efforts to continue the old world are not going to work. But they don't listen. It says that the centurion listened to the shipmaster and the owner of the ship more than Paul. Now, after all, what did Paul know? Well, you know, it turned out he knew quite a bit. You know, in Corinthians, Paul says, among other things, three times he had suffered shipwreck in his voyages. This would be the fourth time, by the way. Paul was a little experienced here. And I think the church, looking back prophetically through the difficulties the world has passed, they have some wisdom from the scriptures about what's going to happen future. But the powers of this world won't credit that. They launch out. And it says, as soon as they launch out, immediately they're hit by this wind called Euroclydon. I think perhaps suggesting this disastrous event that's going to be unleashed that really tosses the ship of state into not billows, not the economic problems we have seen that have swept over the world, but a real unleashed storm. This storm is so intense that it says, this is Acts 27, verse 18, "We be exceedingly tossed with a tempest." And in verse 20, "When neither sun nor stars in many days appeared, and no small tempest lay upon us, all hope that we should be saved was taken away." Maybe it's something like that. A storm of maybe financial disaster that is really going to strike the Western world, that is really going to unsettle people and really lead to a condition unlike today, where they have hardly any hope for the future. Now, we've been through some rough periods, but at no time did I sense that the common public opinion was they're abandoning hope. And they may be a little disappointed by their leaders and the experiences, but there's always that hope we're going to come out, we're going to come back. In this 14 days of storm, sun and the moon were not apparent, the stars. Well, that's what Matthew 24 says will happen before the climax. The sun will be darkened, the moon shall withdraw, shall not shine, the stars will be darkened. I think that's telling us we're coming to the very close and a difficult, dynamic period that's going to really cause the world to take note and even abandon hope. If these billows haven't really done it, maybe those 14 days of storm will. Do those 14 days possibly picture 14 years of really difficult, stormy complex in which the world begins to lose hope? Maybe it's that. Something on that order of magnitude that's required to break up the stony heart and really cause men to look for the right answer. Well, it turns out they passed by this island of Clauda, and now they're able to regain some composure to their ship. They undergird it and they pull it together, and they make a little more progress. Things are still pretty bleak, though. And it says the next day they lightened the ship, and the day after that they even threw out the rigging itself. The world is going to try all kinds of things in their difficulty and in the crisis that hits them. Nothing seems to work, though. It says that for 3 days in particular, on the third day, they threw out the rigging. You know, that reminds me, going back to the Exodus account. The Exodus account before the last plague says they had a period of darkness, just like here. They don't see the sun, the moon, or the stars for 14 days. And there also it talks about 3 days of intense darkness, maybe 3 years of a depth of really something very difficult. But they pass from that. They're still storm-tossed. They're afraid they're going to run into the quicksands of the northern Africa. But the wind blows them another way, and finally on the 14th day, they approach that little island. They don't really know where they are. They just know that at midnight, they're approaching the island, and they're approaching a crisis because they're ready to crash land on the island and the ship go to ruin. This is Acts 27, verse 27. When the 14th night was come, as we were driven up and down in the Adria, about midnight, the shipmen deemed that they drew near to some country. And wasn't it at midnight that in Exodus, the 12th chapter, verse 29, at midnight the death angel passed over? Midnight is the hour of crisis, which finally takes us to the end of this old world. And I think that shipwreck that they're in imminent danger of is the wreck of the ship of state that brings us through the Armageddon crisis into finally the kingdom. Before this happens, Paul is visited that night by an angel. And so Paul has a message for the crew. You find this back in verse 21. After long abstinence, Paul stood forth in the midst of them, and he says, "Sirs, you should have hearkened to me before you left the port." But he says, "You didn't. You're in this complexity." And he says, "I was last night visited by an angel, and the message of the angel was, the ship will go to loss." And we know that's going to happen. The ship of state is going to go to ruin. But the other flip side of it was, all of you will be saved. Because the angel stood before Paul and says, "I'm going to bring you before Caesar. And I'm going to give all of those that sail with you their lives in deference to you." So Paul told them, the ship is going to be ruined, but you will all be saved. I think that's the next message that the church has. After they tell the powers that be that your plans for reestablishing the old world aren't going to be fruitful, the next message at crisis is that there is hope ahead. And that's something that only the church knows. We know the divine plan. We know the plan is to give life to the world in the millennium. The world doesn't know that. Even in Christendom, they don't really know that. They know something about Jesus, but they don't know that the ship of state has to be lost in order for the kingdom to come in and the people will be saved. I think that's the last message that the church gives to a beleaguered world that's ready for some good news. Now, you remember back in the Elijah picture when Elijah was ready to go home? You remember he crossed the Jordan and he smote that Jordan? And sometimes brethren think that's the last message of the church. I think that might be the message, a message of hope, that there is hope in the future. Things look pretty bleak. People are looking for an answer. There will be salvation right around the corner. And then midnight comes. Back in Exodus, at the midnight hour, the death angel passed over the firstborn and they're delivered. The firstborn of Israel, picture the church, who is delivered at this moment of crisis. And I think the church is taken from the scene now. Paul is still here. I think Paul represents the next class of the Lord's people that represent the Lord and his message. That would be like the Elisha class that is left. And they go forward and smite the Jordan again. They have a message as well. What is that message? That's the next message that Paul brings out. You'll find that down in verse 33 and 34. While the day was coming on, Paul besought them all to take meat, saying, "This day is the 14th day that you have tarried and continued fasting, have taken nothing. Wherefore I pray unto you, take some meat, for this is for your health. There shall not a hair of your head fall." When he had thus spoken, Paul took bread. He gave thanks to God in the presence of them all, and when he had broken it, he began to eat. And they were all of good cheer, and they also took some meat. Now, what is this bread that they ate? Is this bread the same as Jesus referred to, the bread from heaven, the only hope for the world in this period of crisis? I will suggest to you that the great company, those that still may be out there, haven't left the house yet, the great company that's lingering, they encourage the world to look towards the Redeemer. You know, they say in a period of crisis, like in a war, there's no atheist in the foxhole. When people are under duress and distress, they begin to look to the only possible hope. That's above. And at this point, a message to look above, that they haven't had much spiritual nourishment for a long time, as the world hasn't. Maybe they should apply themselves to look above. I think that's the message that is represented by this next thing that Paul says. Well, then the day comes. It says in verse 39, when it was day, they didn't know the land, But they discovered a certain creek with a shore, and there they were minded, if possible, to thrust the ship. So they made way for that little spot that looked like a possible landing spot. They got stuck in the sand. It was a place where two seas came together. And during this crisis, it says the winds battered the ship from the back. It began to break up. Every man for himself. They jumped overboard. Some swam on planks. Everybody was saved. They came to the island, and they were greeted with great kindness by what is described as the barbarous people on the island. Well, barbarous people, that just means they weren't Greeks, they weren't Romans, they weren't Jews. It means they were some other kind of people. Well, the Jews here, I think, represent Christendom. The Romans represent the authority politically. What is this little island that's so odd where we're going to come up to the crisis at that island? May I suggest that that little island represents the nation of Israel? That's where all the nations are gathered. That's where the ship of state really wrecks. That's where Ezekiel 38 says, when they come against Israel, I will cause every wall of defense to collapse. I will send fire on the isles. That's where God is going to hold judgment over the nations. They all swim ashore. They're safe on the island. Outside, it's still stormy and raining. The trouble and distress is still abroad everywhere in the world. But at Israel, the ancient worthies are raised during the difficulty, and they bring peace to the land. It's still winter out there, but there's peace at Israel because there's been deliverance. It says the next day, when Paul was gathering some sticks together, a serpent came out and fastened hold upon him, and everybody's waiting for him to drop down dead, and he just shakes it off into the fire. Might that be the last attack of the adversary? But the ancient worthies, when everybody sees that they're there under this attack, maybe they'll perish here, but they just shake it off as something of nothing, no consequence. That burden is dissipated. And now it says, for the first time in the whole narrative, Paul goes around the island healing everybody of their diseases. Isn't that what the ancient worthies will do in the kingdom? Start healing the world of their problems. But here, it's only limited to that island. And so when the winter is past and the trouble out there in the world begins to diminish, now the kingdom is ready to spread its influence to nation after nation. And they get a new ship. It says they find a new ship, just like that old one. It's from Alexandria. It's a grain ship on the way to Rome. They get on this, but it's under new management. It's under the sign of Castor and Pollux, which are the sign of Gemini, which anciently used to be not the twins, but the sign of the groom and his bride. This next ship of state is under the auspices of Christ and his bride as they venture forward on their way to Rome to universal dominion. So they go first to the island, and there they're received well. Then they go to the mainland, and again another port of call, and then they walk overland, and they finally come to Rome, and all the prisoners are delivered to a new authority. And Paul, for 2 years, is under some bondage, as the ancient worthies will be, but under liberty to preach the kingdom of God to all that come to him. And that's where the book of Acts stops. And I think that's where our picture stops. During the next age of the Spirit, when the ancient worthies are preaching the kingdom to all that will come. Now, this has been quick. This has been a little thumbnail resume of this last experience. But I think it tells us something about the troubles that we have yet to go through. We've been through a lot. We've been through World War I and World War II. We've seen the breakup of all the colonial powers. We've seen the Islamic terrorism that has sprung up in a new kind of war, and we've seen the billows pass over us, not yet finished. And I think we're coming to a period of stability thereafter, and then to a period of stormy, difficult experience, probably financially structured after that. People will fairly much give up hope before finally the crisis of Armageddon lands the world at the shores of Israel, where the old ship of state will be broken. And finally, the new kingdom inaugurated. We've got a couple of decades left. I would say maybe 2 decades before we reach that point where the fast, the Day of Atonement is passed, and the high calling begins to wind down. And after that, do those 14 days of storm represent 14 years of stormy weather out there? Maybe. Maybe that's going to finally make the world ready to look above to the bread from heaven and finally see the deliverance. Whether this in detail comes about in this fashion or some better way, we know finally the kingdom of God will be established and will be the answer to all of the world's problems.